The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is The Dan Proft Show.
Welcome to The Dan Proft Show. Thank you for joining us on this Friday edition. It's been another exciting, exhausting, exasperating week. Particularly when it comes to the Supreme Court on the exhausting and exasperating scores. Chief Justice John Roberts joined the four liberals, as he so often does, in ruling that the Trump administration hadn't properly followed the Administrative Procedure Act in ruling that Trump cannot discontinue the DACA program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, initiated by President Obama in 2012. That's the Wall Street Journal opining. Chief Justice John Roberts joined the four liberals, as he so often does. Indeed. A remarkable blow against the rule of law, against the presidential, against the executive's virtual plenary powers when it comes to immigration, and in favor of the notion, the remarkable notion, as was noted by Justice Thomas in his dissent, the essential consequence of this is that a president can create an unlawful policy without legislation from Congress, which is what President Obama did and conceded that he did. But a future president cannot lawfully undo the unlawful action of the prior president without first jumping through regulatory hoops that can take years. Thomas explaining, a president should not have to follow normal administrative procedures to reverse a policy that was unlawful in the first place. That's the sort of common sense that you get from a Justice Thomas, and that is suspended when political considerations trump the rule of law, which is what happened here. Tom Cotton, senator from Arkansas, reacting, if the chief justice believes his political judgment is so exquisite, I invite him to resign, travel to Iowa, and get elected. I suspect voters will find his strange views no more compelling than do the principled justices on the court. And that the implication that Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, is playing politics from the bench is not only clear, it's accurate. Judging is not a game. It's not supposed to be a game. But sadly, over recent years, more and more, Chief Justice Roberts has been playing games with the court to achieve the policy outcomes he desires. Right. Because you have this false binary that has been presented by DACA defenders. And you have, of course, the sentimentality that is used to advance the false binary. The false binary is stories like this.
This decision means that I will be able to apply to residency programs and hopefully achieve my dream of becoming a surgeon. The truth is, America is my home.
Mm-hmm. And the truth is that most Americans across the political spectrum are sympathetic to the plight of children brought here by their parents illegally through no fault of their own. And the truth is that most Americans would like to do something about that. And the truth is, I know this requires a little bit of institutional memory that the press corps does not possess. The truth is that President Trump proposed a compromise on this very issue. Did he not? Has everyone forgot? President Trump, in trying to negotiate with the House, all the way back in January of 2018. Can you remember 2.5 years ago? Not only did he propose temporary legal status for Dreamers, temporary legal status and work authorization for 3 years if their protection gets revoked. He also supported a 3-year extension of the legal status of immigrants temporarily protected from deportation. Then he sweetened the pot by not just including the roughly 700,000 Dreamer immigrants who have applied for DACA protection since 2012, but he added an additional 1.1 million illegal immigrants who could have qualified but had not yet applied. I'll see your 700,000. I'll more than double it to the 1.1 million who are eligible but didn't apply in exchange for $5 billion in funding for border wall to establish a barrier on our southern border. And the Democrats didn't go for it because they rather have the Dreamers as a mascot than do something to advance the Dreamers' actual interests. Could have been settled 2.5 years ago and properly through the interplay between the executive and the legislative branches, where policymaking should actually take place, not at the Supreme Court level. And again, just to make sure we understand what President Obama understood when he initiated this, David Harsanyi has a good piece in National Review in October of 2010. Obama, I am a president. I'm not a king. I can't do these things just by myself. We have a system of government that requires Congress to work with the executive branch to make it happen. In March of 2011, with respect to the notion I can just suspend deportations through executive order, that's just not the case. For me to simply, through executive order, ignore those congressional mandates would not conform with my appropriate role as a president. In July of 2011, now I know some people want me to bypass Congress and change the laws on my own. And believe me, right now dealing with Congress, believe me, the idea of doing things on my own is very tempting. I promise you, not just on immigration reform, but that's not how our system works. That's not how our democracy functions. That's not how our Constitution is written. In September of 2011, Obama again. And I think there's been a great disservice done to the cause of getting the DREAM Act passed and getting comprehensive immigration passed by perpetuating the notion that somehow by myself I can go and do these things. It's just not true. We live in a democracy. You have to pass bills through the legislature, and then I can sign it. And for years, he argued that Congress wouldn't, for years, Democrats argued that Obama was impelled to act because Congress wouldn't do its job. Yeah. And so he acted. 8 years ago, this, and here's the reaction from Obama. 8 years ago this week, we protected young people raised as part of our American family from deportation. And Harsanyi's comment, we didn't do anything. You did by yourself without any congressional authorization against your own stated positions, which Harsanyi memorialized and I just read. I mean, so what is the point here? There's a couple of points. One is you can be for the rule of law and for doing something to provide permanent status to Dreamers. Number two, President Trump supported that position. He tried to advance that cause just 2.5 years ago, even more aggressively than President Obama initiated it unlawfully. And yet, congressional Democrats, House Democrats in particular, not willing to deal on border funding. When it was not willing to deal on border funding, or when it was not willing to deal with President Obama, President Obama just came over the top and acted unlawfully, as he so conceded. President Trump can't withdraw his illegal action without going through some statutory administrative process. It makes no sense. It makes no sense. This is all based on what's popular. That's what this is. That's why Cruz calls it castigates Roberts. That judging is not a game. That's why Cotton talks about politician John Roberts rather than Supreme Court Justice John Roberts. And I mean, what is the point of having these institutions? What is the point of the rule of law if it's just going to be what's popular, if it's just going to be subject to the mob. I mean, this is exactly, by the way, what the founders warned about. This is exactly what they tried to set up. Well, they did. They conceived institutions to avoid the passions of the mob in any given moment. And by the way, for those of you who are subscribing, and for those in your social circle subscribing to this idea, you like the outcome, so don't worry about the process. The ends justify the means. Okay, you set that standard, and the ends justify the means could be used for ends that you don't particularly like. It's such a terrible precedent to set, particularly by the highest court in the land. And so it goes. Mob rule. And that ends badly. This is Dan Proft.
Podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Peter Wood, writing in The Spectator, argues that America would be on a path to a better, more enlightened society if we defunded colleges. The colleges that survive the coming debacle will be stronger for it. Propping them up in their hour of weakness will simply help a malignant force in our culture continue to erode our national confidence and self-respect. Well, the question, though, is, at this point, isn't the genie out of the bottle? To answer that question for us, we're joined now by the author of said piece, Peter Wood, president of the National Association of Scholars. Peter, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Is the contagion spread such that even defunding the colleges, as you suggest, or seeing, you know, 1/5 of colleges close their doors wouldn't really change the malignancy of the university with respect to our culture?
Well, it's not something that's going to change overnight, for sure. I think we're already seeing this in the responses from college presidents and chancellors to the riots in the cities around the country. They've, in huge numbers, issued their own statements in which basically they're legitimizing the protest culture, which, of course, is often violent, sometimes deadly, and they're committing themselves ever more to using their institutions as agents of what they call social justice, which essentially means propagandizing the students into a hatred of America. So the initial response of the higher education establishment is to double down on what they're already doing, but they are headed at a very high speed towards a brick wall. And that is that American higher education is in a dire financial crisis that's only going to get worse. So they are willing to spend ever more money doing what they already do, but they're going to run out of money. And some of them will founder because of that. Some boards of trustees are going to wake up and say, wait a minute, this isn't what we came in for. And the very rich institutions, the ones with endowments of $1 billion and up, will shrug it off and continue to do what they were doing all along anyway.
Your suggestion, though, is that some market feedback, some accountability in the marketplace may be instructive for at least some percentage of the institutions of higher learning so that you would see some adjustment in response to the market feedback.
I think that's going to happen in two ways. One is that there will be institutions that really are susceptible to the market and will adjust their ways. They may have to do some fairly radical surgery in their administrations, but their desire to survive will trump their desire for political correctness, at least in some cases. The other thing that will happen is that if the higher education sector as we know it contracts, there will be new entrants into the field. We still will need educated people to do the jobs that require more advanced expertise. And those people are going to get their education someplace. It may not be at the current collection of colleges and universities with their deep investment in propagandizing them, but they will have some creative destruction here. There will be new colleges that take their places.
Do you have some optimism that that creative destruction, to borrow from Schumpeter, would be in the direction of restoring something we used to have called a liberal education, small l?
Yeah, I am optimistic, but I'm also ready to make distinctions. There will be plenty of people who thought that the whole purpose of going to college was to get job credentials, and there will be institutions that suit themselves to that part of the market where you go and get your degree in business or nursing or some other field that has direct application. And that's fine, but it does leave this other space open where traditional liberal education used to be and is no more. So there are certainly going to be students in the millions who want to go to college to learn how to write really well, to think clearly, and that market is now woefully underserved. There are a handful of colleges. One that usually comes to mind is Hillsdale College that serve it, but they are small colleges that can handle a few thousand students, whereas there are probably millions of students who really thirst for that kind of education, and no one is serving them now at all.
You suggest the way to defund colleges is for alumni to refuse to cut checks to their alma maters. I wonder what you think of this piece at Tablet Magazine this week from Leah Leibovitz, who argues that one way to bring the reckoning to higher education is to persuade companies to not make a BA a threshold requirement for employment consideration. Going so far, does Leibovitz to argue that people should hire non-college graduates only because college is what poisons so many of the graduates then enter the workforce and bring the college campus to the corporate world?
I read the article. I thought it was a genius, provocative idea. I'd probably have to moderate it. You probably don't want to rule out all college graduates because
there's
some good ones out there.
Right.
But on the general idea that higher education is feeder to the world of white-collar employment has exploded already. We know that the skills that college graduates are bringing to that sector of the workforce are mostly negligible, and that it would be far better if the employers of the world were looking at actual skills of people, or at least their potential to gain those skills, than simply credentials. Now, we know that there is a reason, and it's not utterly irrational, that colleges do that. The reason goes back to the Duke decision of, I think it was 1972, where the Supreme Court outlawed the use of intelligence tests and other work-related tests for hiring on the basis that those were a cover for racial discrimination. Since then, the employers of the world have realized that since they can't filter students or graduates or potential employees on any rational basis of their own, they would use a college degree as at least some form of surrogate for finding out if the students were at least capable of showing up at work and putting in a regular day. Now, that solution might have worked for a while, but it doesn't work anymore because the colleges have become such deadbeats when it comes to actually producing in students a work ethic, a love of the task of self-advancing through achievement. So we are left now not knowing what a college degree really means and whether it can be relied on. Given that, I think that Leibovitz's suggestion makes a lot of sense. It just puts the burden back on employers to do a better job figuring out what it is that students know and what their characters are and what they can bring to the task. A further complication is that the personnel offices, human resources in many of these companies, are utterly swamped with the politically correct graduates of colleges who know only how to sort people out by their commitment to the shibboleths of our age. So they may find out whether the potential graduate is a ardent enough supporter of Black Lives Matter, has the right views on patriarchy, has the right views on Israel and Palestine. We'll do all those sorts of questions that have absolutely nothing to do with the individual's qualification to do the job.
Well, that may be that may be the place to start. The first non-college grad you hire is your HR director, and that can help change the culture that quickly. He is Peter Wood. He's president of the National Association of Scholars. Check out his piece, spectator.us, which I'll tweet out at Dan Prof Show. Defund colleges, not cops. Peter, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to The Dan Prof Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Another solid offering from Holman Jenkins this week in the Wall Street Journal. Race problem or crime problem? He notes some of the academic research about crime in America. Starting in the 1980s, researchers identified 880 census tracts out of about 56,000 nationally. 880 out of 56,000 in America, where social disorder made a law-abiding life difficult. It's about 2 million people, including many people who are not black, lived in such places in 2005. Except in the media and popular culture, and perhaps in the minds of police officers, they hardly represent the experience of all 41 million black Americans. Their residents also overwhelmingly want out. Unfortunately, the thrust of public policy in recent decades has been to keep them in place, partly because doing so maintains some of the safest seats in American politics. Among the unhelpful gestures, elite opposition to charter schools, high marginal tax rates on people moving from welfare to work, housing subsidies tied to downtrodden and jobless neighborhoods. And now defund the police, as if doing so wouldn't leave these neighborhoods even less protected, while suburban communities and private enclaves double down on security spending. And brings him to what Zach Goldberg over at Georgia State University calls America's white saviors, the activists that are projecting they're here to help when they're advancing policies that keep law-abiding people in those areas, despite their desire to escape. Isn't that interesting? What we understand about various institutions that form the bedrock of a civil society. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by our friend John Ponder, the founder and CEO of Hope for Prisoners, Inc., who also had a solid offering this week in the Wall Street Journal about how the police can help rebuild lives, and he's got firsthand experience on the topic. John, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Dan, good morning. Thank you for having me.
You know, what about that? What about the idea of how politics plays in here? It's not been an argument that has been advanced in too many places in this way. The idea that, number one, you're talking about a relatively small group of people, those who live in crime-infested neighborhoods and those who are those people who commit crimes are a very small fraction of the 41 million black Americans, and the experience of those 41 million black Americans. And the fact is that there's some political incentives to keep people exactly where they are, even though they want out, because, again, they represent safe districts for members of Congress and members of state legislatures and the like.
Yeah, Dan, you know, I think that we're in a sad state of affairs. But, you know, I'm really hoping that as a country, communities across this country can get away from that us versus them mentality and find ways that we'll be able to work together to find some common ground so we can bring healing to the ills of our community.
And that's what you've been doing since you got out of federal prison. We've had you on the show before. You've told your story. The president of the United States has told your story. So your story is getting a lot of airtime, as well it should, because it's an unbelievable epiphany that you had and a turnaround that you've had that you're paying forward. And, you know, this feeds right into the last two high profile police involved shootings. Police involved killings, George Floyd in Minneapolis, of course, and now Rashard Brooks in Atlanta. And, interestingly, in both of those individuals, the Brooks and Floyd had criminal histories. They had served time. And so I wonder how you look at those cases and think about the lives of those two individuals and say, boy, if they could have got into Hope for Prisoners, maybe they would have never been in that situation, or what it speaks to in terms of how to help people like Floyd and Brooks, who may have been very genuine in trying to stay on the straight and narrow, stay on that straight and narrow.
Yeah, you know, first of all, you know, our heart breaks for both of those instances. It's a sad sense of injustice. You know, our communities are heartbroken. Our country is heartbroken. And this is the reason why Hope for Prisoners exists, for those men and women returning back into those communities, for us to be able to find ways to be able to help raise them up out of poverty, put them in a position to where they're able to earn a sustainable wage and take care of themselves and take care of their family. And as you know, we have done that hand in hand with the help of the police department.
And John, let me just hold it right there and let's pick up on exactly that. Your partnership with the police department in helping people turn their lives around as they transition from prison to society. More with John Ponder, founder and CEO of Hope for Prisoners, right after this.
Good seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're talking with John Ponder, founder and CEO of Hope for Prisoners out in Nevada. And before the break, we were just getting to the secret sauce, the formula that John has developed with Hope for Prisoners to helping formerly incarcerated transition to a return to society and be productive upon that return. So, John, pick it up there for us.
Sure. You know, our partnership with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department has grown over the last 11 years to over 100 officers that we have a part of our mechanism that helps to train and mentor men and women returning to those communities to help them to never reoffend again. And the reason why we started that relationship, we were approached by law enforcement, and they had said they had come to the realization that they cannot arrest their way out of the problems in those communities. So how could they step outside the box as an agency and come up with ways to help people, you know, really, really succeed in life? And the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department has done a phenomenal job at doing that.
And talk about that in your own life, because, I mean, it's you know, seemingly the most unlikeliest of things that those who provided such help for you when you got out included the federal agent who arrested you and the judge who sentenced you.
Yeah, Dan, and that made such a huge impact in my life because, you know, I grew up in those communities that we're talking about today. I grew up hating the police, did not want to have a conversation with them, you know, turn my back and walk away. And it was something about the interactions with that law enforcement agency, Richard Beasley, the FBI agent who was on my case, his interactions with me and the way he treated me. I saw a human side of him. When I began to see his heart and see the man that God created him to be, it changed my whole perception of law enforcement. And, you know, I began to have a relationship with him. You know, we began to become friends. And when I took a look at that, I wanted to see, because it had such a big, huge impact on my life, is how can we replicate that, right? How could we help formerly incarcerated people begin to view law enforcement from a whole other set of lenses? And how could we get law enforcement to view people who are coming home from the prison system, who are truly fighting for a second chance, to help them to, you know, change their optics of it, and for them to come alongside and be able to help people? It's a huge win-win for our entire community. And again, that gets us away from the us versus them mentality.
Is the experience that you find in terms of the eyes that are open, the scales that drop from the eyes, people who had previously dehumanized the institution they didn't like, or the group they didn't like. So police dehumanizing the people that they have to police as street thugs. And as you say, you and other people in particular neighborhoods dehumanizing the police as, you know, racist pigs. Once you get is that dehumanization of the other? Do you see that as sort of the fundamental similarity and problem going in both directions?
Absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because it works on both sides. And the best way for me to explain this, and I'll tell you from my personal experience and let you know, that you ever think about how close that word enemy comes to the inner me, mm-hmm. right? And I spent a lifetime fighting enemies on the outside mm-hmm. until I took a look at the enemies that were laying dormant on the inner me. And once I conquered the enemies on the inner me, the enemies on the outside disappeared. And that's when I had come to the realization, for John Ponder, for me, it was never the police. It was always those things that were going on the inner me. And I think that if we look at that from both sides, we both sides examine, you know, what's going on the inside of us. Formerly incarcerated people getting them back out into the community to become productive members of the community, right? We really need to see what that looks like. But on the other side, with law enforcement, I think law enforcement really needs to get back to the basics of, you know, why am I here? I'm here to protect and to serve. But what else can I do outside the box to make sure that my community is safe? You know, getting great at locking people up and law enforcement, they've gotten great with that. But how could you take that the next a step further and begin to help people in communities across the country? Right here in Las Vegas, the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, you know, we have a multicultural advisory council that's made up of every race, color, creed, and nationality that meets with the sheriff once a month, and they share with them the cries of the people. These are the community leaders that out in the community listen, their boots on the ground, and have direct access to the sheriff. Our police department is made up of 10 different area commands with over 110 community-oriented police officers that are out in those communities, that are playing basketball with the kids, that are reading in the elementary school, that are visiting our churches and our synagogues and our mosques, developing relationships with the community. And if you think about it, Dan, across this country, people do not trust police. Mm-hmm. And the reason why they don't trust police, Dan, is because they're not in relationship with police. And in what relationship could you ever establish trust unless there's life rubbing up against life and the spirit of complete transparency, that we have more in common than we have differences? There is no big I's and little U's. We are all as one. And out of that transparency, the relationship gets that established. And out of those relationships, we can begin to build up trust.
And by establishing those relationships, just in terms of, like, this is not just mellifluous rhetoric from John Ponder. The recidivism rate of individuals who've gone through the Hope for Prisoners program, your program, versus what the recidivism rate is generally, just to remind our listeners?
No, absolutely. If you take a look at the national recidivism rate, it's north of 79%, which means that 79% of people will return back to our communities within 3 years without support of the community. They'll return back to the system. But we are very proud, because of our partnership with law enforcement and bringing other people in, our recidivism rate is floating at 6%.
Wow.
6% of the individuals that have been through our process are out in the community, productive, law-abiding members.
Outstanding. Outstanding. The ties that bind. It works, and it's hard work. And John Ponder's doing it through Hope for Prisoners with police in partnership. John Ponder, founder and CEO of Hope for Prisoners. John, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan, thanks so much.
Take care.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and mentioned examples of the sentimental barbarians cannibalizing their own. The Maoist purgers, choose the descriptor or phraseology you like. I got a good one. This is out of Chicago. Of course it is. The incubator of terrible politicians and general kleptocracy. Mayor Lori Lightfoot, quickly becoming one of the more high-profile mayors in the country because of her disdain for people who disagree with her, her enjoyment of taking away people's freedoms, businesses, property, perhaps the leading shutdown mayor in the country. Truly. We still haven't opened quite yet the lakefront. We haven't opened outside in Chicago except to outdoor seating for restaurants. She needs the sales tax revenue. Well, this is fun. The Chicago Teachers Union, which is a Leninist organization, tweeted out a meme, Scooby-Doo-based meme of Lori Lightfoot. It's the Scooby and the gang standing around Lori Lightfoot, who's tied up. You know, they unmask her, as was always done in the Scooby-Doo episodes. They unmask the somebody who's in a police uniform. They pull the mask off, and it's Lori Lightfoot in a police uniform, and she's tied up. A Scooby-Doo meme, a cartoon. The Chicago Teachers Union, a Leninist organization with a history, by the way, of African-American leadership. This is what Lori Lightfoot said of this meme.
Well, I haven't actually seen the tweet, but it has been described to me. And I guess I'll say this. If that kind of tweet, which is clearly racist, had been put forward by a right-wing group, we would rightly be denouncing them. And I think our scorn should be no less because it was put out by the CTU.
Yeah. There's a couple of things. One is she hasn't seen it, but it's been described to her. So it's clearly racist. Okay. Sure. It's clearly racist. I guess because it's four white cartoons. And a dog, you know, Scoobs, that makes it racist? Or is it because she's in a police uniform and she believes the police are racist? It's hard to know exactly why it's racist, although David Goldenberg, the Midwest Regional Director of the Anti-Defamation League, said he was deeply concerned about this tweet and image, adding the Chicago Teachers Union needs to do better than this and owes Lightfoot an apology. Uh-huh. In Murder City, USA, as the Wall Street Journal termed Chicago, this is what we're discussing. Cartoon memes from one Leninist group directed at Leninist Mayor Lori Lightfoot. The cannibalization that occurs when, you know, you just can't purge fast enough. And you run out of people to purge. This is Dan Proff.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proff Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Again, follow us on social media at Dan Proft Show on Twitter and Facebook, and at Prof Dan at Instagram. Dan Cathy, the son of Chick-fil-A founder Truett Cathy, the CEO of Chick-fil-A at present. Chick-fil-A developed a great reputation as a company that was inspired by Christian values and operated as part of its corporate culture based on those values. Closed on Sundays, for example. And then last fall, it was announced that Chick-fil-A would stop through its foundation supporting organizations like the Salvation Army and the Fellowship of Christian Athletes. And we were told at the time by Franklin Graham and others that don't be afraid. Don't think that Dan Cathy is walking away from his Christian beliefs. Don't think that he is bending the knee to the secular humanist mobs in America. He's not. Just a refocusing of the foundation's priorities to poverty and other related issues. And I was a bit skeptical at the time. Didn't buy it. Well, over the weekend, Dan Cathy participated in a roundtable discussion on race at Passion City Church in Atlanta with the founder of that church, Louis Giglio, and a Christian rapper named Lecrae. He spoke about being inspired, did Dan Cathy, several years ago by the story of a young man at a Texas church revival who shined the shoes of an elderly black man at that revival over his feelings of racism in his hometown. And so picking up from there, Dan Cathy offered this.
So I invite folks just to put some words to action here. And if we need to find somebody that needs to have their shoe shine, we need to just go right on over and shine their shoes. And whether they got tennis shoes on or not, maybe they got sandals on, it really doesn't matter. But there's a time in which we need to have, you know, some personal action here. Maybe we need to give them a hug, too,
brother. And some stock in Chick-fil-A. Yeah.
But I bought about 1,500 of these, and I gave them to all our Chick-fil-A operators and staff a number of years ago.
Yeah, he's talking about brushes to shine shoes. That's what the 1,500 was. Lecrae, I think, is more directionally correct, talking about ownership society. That's really what he's talking about. How about stock in the company? I don't need your sentimentality. We need opportunity and ownership, and hopefully not through expropriation, but through accomplishment. Is that an instance where Dan Cathy used a wonderful Christian symbol to prostrate himself before the sentimental barbarians, before the mob? Because that's how I view it. For more perspective on this, pleased to be joined again by our friend Rusty Reno, who's the editor at First Things, firstthings.com. Rusty, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be with you, Dan.
How did you interpret Dan Cathy's remarks and suggestion that his additional suggestion was effectively white Christians should go out and find black people whose shoes they can shine to atone for their racism?
Well, I didn't read it that way. He said to go out and shine the shoes of anybody who needs a shine. So he didn't make it into a racial thing. I mean, you can see he wants to say something that promotes reconciliation in a time when the Black Lives Matter folks are all about demonization. And so I guess I take a more benevolent interpretation of what he's trying to say. He's trying to say something.
He
hopes is going to promote reconciliation. And it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing.
Well, he said, I'm not quite persuaded yet. He said, we cannot be silent. Okay, somebody has to fight, and God has so blessed our city. But it's shameful how we let things get so out of whack. Any expressions of a contrite heart, of a sense of humility, a sense of shame, a sense of embarrassment, an apologetic heart, I think that's what our world needs to hear today. You know, I'm all for humility and a contrite heart and all of those things, but most of us white people were out of sight, out of mind, oblivious to it. Are you saying that about white people's obliviousness to injustice against black Americans? We cannot let this moment pass. It just strikes me as sort of the banality of we need to have a national conversation on race, which we've been having for my entire lifetime and well before that.
No, I think you're right on that score, that the city of Atlanta is, you know, run by black-dominated cohort of politicians. And so if Atlanta's got problems, and, you know, who doesn't? Welcome to the fallen human condition.
Yeah, right.
Every municipality's got problems. And I think Black Lives Matter itself is not really all about race. It's got all kinds of things in its platform about LGBT stuff, you know, dismantling the traditional family, and so forth. And pulling down Christopher Columbus statues doesn't have anything to do with race.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like race is just, it's so 1960s, and whatever the troubles and turmoil and unrest that we're facing has much more complex and multifaceted sources.
And so how concerned are you about where the mob takes us and a mob culture takes us? We've seen Supreme Court decisions this week where political considerations were preeminent over the rule of law and the interpretation of it in both the BASTA case and the DACA ruling, I would argue, that came down yesterday. And then, of course, we're seeing people that are willing to say and do anything to win reprieve from the mob. And most of those people are in positions of status and authority in our cultural and civic institutions.
I think the latter problem is, I mean, both are huge problems, but the latter one is we're in a kind of hysterical moment right now where everybody's rushing to make ritual confessions of their great guilt and sin, political sin, not moral sin, in order to protect themselves. And the people who run companies or are deans of universities and so on, they don't hesitate to throw somebody overboard to protect themselves. So it's a very Hobbesian situation right now as the woke mobs rush around and effectively lynch people, professionally at least. They lynch them.
And I think that there's a real misunderstanding among those throwing in with the mob that somehow suspension of the rule of law or a Hobbesian state of nature, as you were referring to, would be better for the little guy. Let me tell you something. A Hobbesian state of nature is going to be a lot better for the bigger guy like me than it is going to be for the little guy, regardless of your race or religion or anything else. You know, you want to just make this about might makes right. That's when the little guy gets trampled.
Well, the whole defund the police, what that means is, okay, let's say that they reduce the size of the Chicago police force. Well, those policemen aren't just going to go away. They're going to be hired by rich people as private protection. So, you know, no one needs to worry about Winnetka. If wealthy people in Winnetka will find a way to get protection. But it's the people on the south side of Chicago that will be thrown to the wolves because of human... I mean, every community has rapacious people that will take advantage of others. Withdrawing or defunding the police will really be very tough on poor neighborhoods. Those folks don't have the resources to protect themselves. They need the civil society to protect them.
What's your perspective? We talked a little bit last time you were on the show, your perspective on how faith leaders across the various traditions behaved during the lockdowns in terms of rallying to protect religious liberty interests. What about here in terms of trying to promote a deeper understanding of our common humanity? How have faith leaders of all the faith traditions responded, do you think?
I don't see any strong voices out there. At this point, you know, certainly various bishops and others have tried to say things that would be helpful in the current situation. But I think that because of the Twitter mobs and the woke mob that's out for blood, really, to be honest with you, that I think most religious leaders are sort of trying to be very, very careful not to say something that will get them attacked or will... you know, some way get into the crosshairs of the mob. So that's the problem. No one's standing up to the mob right now.
It turns out to be a huge problem, right? Because as C.S. Lewis observed, courage is the formation of every virtue at its testing point. So if you don't have courage, then you can possess no other virtue. And if we have nobody exhibiting courage, then we have a society without virtue.
Yes. I mean, back to the Hobbesian state of nature. And I do think this is a very difficult time, and it's difficult because of the lack of courage. You know, one of the things I think this is a judgment on baby boomers, because baby boomers are you know in these positions of responsibility. You know, so baby boomers are 60, you know, between 60 and 80 years old. They should be the calm, wise heads that say enough, stop. This is getting out of hand. But instead, they either agree or they're hiding in their basements.
Yeah, it's a good
waiting
point.
For the mobs to pass.
Right. Where are the, you know, the metaphorical village elders? Yes. Rusty Reno, editor at First Things, firstthings.com. Rusty, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for being on the show.
Take care.
We don't get fooled again.
Show at danproffshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Friend of the show, Don Boudreau, over at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, I thought made one of the more poignant observations of the week, very simply stating when he was on our program, prosperity does not come from smearing green ink on paper. Right. axiomatic, but you wouldn't know it based on the policy discussion and based on what the Fed is doing to provide liquidity to the market, in addition to the fiscal disaster relief that was provided by Congress, with perhaps more in tow, perhaps also that some of that coming in the form of Trump's version of shovel-ready projects. We'll see. But the question is, how is the Fed managing what it has to manage in the face of unprecedented government action to shut down the United States economy? This is something that really requires a check on a daily basis, not just with the weekly unemployment numbers or the monthly weekly unemployment claims or the monthly unemployment numbers. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Thomas Vartanian. He is the executive director and professor of law at Scalia Law School program at the Scalia Law School's program on financial regulation and technology, former bank regulator and private practitioner, who will have a book on financial crises in America out in early 2021. If we're all still around, we'll see. Tom Vartanian, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan.
Well, I'm sure you don't disagree with your friend Don Boudreau's observation about the source of prosperity, but you do argue in a most recent piece that you penned for TheHill.com that the Fed has done a pretty good job providing the liquidity the market needs, the economy needs to this juncture, but there are some, well, many pitfalls ahead.
Yeah, I think the problem we've got is we're in an unprecedented time when if you do too little, the economy collapses, and if you do too much, you've got an enormous overhang and hangover that you've got to worry about for a number of years. And if we just look back into what happened in 2008, we were still working through the hangover of the 2008 panic when this one occurred. And so this one is going to inject even more capital, even more cash into the economy. And I don't think anybody really knows what the impact of that is going to be. And my argument essentially is that the Fed should try to tether what it's doing to strategies that tell them and us how these things are going to be reversed at some time.
Yeah, you mentioned tethering to exit strategies. And I wonder if there's any indication you've gleaned from some of Jay Powell's pronouncements over the last couple of weeks about what you know, if not what the strategy is, what direction it's going in terms of any milestones that say it's time to exit, it's time to raise interest rates, it's time to shut down the municipal facility, municipal lending facility, and those sorts of things.
Yeah, well, I think Jay's doing a good job in responding to the problems. But I was sort of intrigued by his statement last week where he said the Fed has crossed a lot of red lines that have not been crossed before and created situations in which we, quote, have to figure it out afterwards. And I think what we've learned in prior financial crisis in this country, in 2008 was the most, I think, illustrative, is that figuring it out afterwards is not always that easy. I mean, we're sitting here with Fannie and Freddie, shockingly, still in federal conservatorship for 12 years. So it's not always easy to figure out how to reverse a lot of these levers.
One of the things that you suggested in a previous op-ed that we just discussed last time, but should be brought up again because there's been sort of some movement on it, a pandemic revitalization finance corp, somewhat similar to TARP from 2008 that people probably remember. You know, part of what this corporation you're suggesting be stood up could do would be to invest in the preferred stock of large and small companies for the purposes of maintaining unemployment and other social goods and economic ones. And we have had the Fed move into buying more corporate debt recently. Is that sort of a backdoor way of, do you think, of getting to the place you suggested?
Well, I don't think so, because at the end of the day, buying debt and injecting liquidity into the system will only last so long. And what I mean by that is, eventually, somebody's got to be paid actual dollars, and eventually forbearance wears out, and eventually your balance sheet starts to suffer as your shareholder equity begins to shrink from losses, because liquidity is not going to save you forever. And my thought was, if we're going to set up a Reconstruction Finance Corporation vehicle, such as a Revitalization Finance Corp, such like we did in 1932 in the Depression, it ought to be done only if it absolutely necessarily has to be done to save the economy. But if it is done, what it's got to do is it's got to pinpoint the companies that are in most extremists, where communities are in most extremists, and buy equity securities, logically preferred stock, as the government took in Fannie and Freddie, to support those companies so that they don't fail. Because the bottom line is a rush towards bankruptcy by thousands of companies that wouldn't otherwise not have gone into that situation is not the best way to restructure ourselves out of this predicament.
But it did, but by buying up corporate debt, taking another step, is Jay Powell sort of on that road to what you're suggesting, or at least willing to contemplate that's where the road ends?
Yeah, I think that's right, Dan. I think buying corporate debt is along that road. It doesn't get to injecting equity into companies, but it certainly is another step along that road.
You also mentioned that this corporation, were to be set up, should provide first dollar reinsurance to businesses around the country who are likely hearing from their insurance, the people who cover them, that that they're not going to be paid for business interruption under their policies. And so you want to do this to avoid litigation as well, as well as delay. That's one idea. How much of a business, a failure to get business interruption compensation do you think, how big is that problem? I guess what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, I think we missed an opportunity here, because my sense as a former regulator is we always ought to try to use mechanisms that are already in place rather than reinventing something and creating a new bureaucracy. So my thought was most businesses have business interruption insurance. Most of them are getting declinations from their carriers saying it's not covered. A pandemic is not covered. So it seemed to me the easiest way to get the money out to these companies, as opposed to paycheck loans and all the rest of that, was to simply say, insurance companies, you pay those claims, and the Revitalization Finance Corporation, mm-hmm. or whoever it is that the Treasury sets up, will reinsure them and pay you. So that, in effect, you've already got a payment mechanism set up out there through the insurance companies. You just have to reinsure what they're paying out.
He is Professor Thomas Vartanian, the Executive Director and Professor of Law at Scalia Law School's Program on Financial Regulation and Technology. Look forward to a book that he will publish on financial crises in America in early 21. Professor Vartanian, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Take care. When a problem comes along, you must whip it before the cream sets out too long. You must whip it when something's going wrong. You must whip it. Now whip it.
You're listening to The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. When it comes to a reckoning for the public health professionals, if they want at least half the country to listen to them going forward, it seems to me that it's more than just a matter of admitting how far off so many of the models were, so many of the models upon which public policy decisions were made. It's also that too many continue to be silent when the press corps is demagoguing data. So over the last week, after many of the protests with respect to police have subsided, they return to their COVID-19 end of days narrative, demagoguing states, particularly states governed by Republicans, that have reopened, when the data really doesn't support the hysteria or the hysteria they're trying to foment. In point of fact, again, we go through this. You're looking at less than 6% of Americans tested each week are found to have the virus. You have overall across the nation, the daily average case rate dropping. Even in states where you have a spike in cases, which was anticipated, you are not seeing anything approaching a placing of their healthcare infrastructure in jeopardy in terms of their ability to deal with patients who have severe case of COVID-19, such that they require hospitalization or even intensive care unit treatment. So it's really important, I think, if these public health professionals across disciplines, but in sort of the infectious disease space, want people to listen to them, that they start being a little bit more humble and a little bit more aggressive when it comes to listening to, watching politicians and pundits demagogue data. I spoke with Chris von Schiffelve, who's a virologist, about this topic last night.
I'm a modeling epidemiologist by background, so I build this kind of model all the time, and so I have a little more sympathy towards modeling epidemiologists than the average person does. But I think it's important from the perspective of restoring public trust in public health that we face these accusations and challenges head on. And I think one way of doing that is there has to be a clear admission that most of the models have really been quite wide of the mark in this outbreak. Now, this is a novel pathogen. It doesn't behave anything like the similar pathogens that we know. Our model for how a respiratory coronavirus, a severe respiratory coronavirus, behaves is, of course, SARS, and to a lesser extent, MERS, least respiratory syndrome. And because COVID-19, or SARS-CoV-2, has been so much faster to spread compared to SARS and caused so many more cases, we have, I think, largely slid into the other extreme and be overly cautious.
And, you know, it's fine if this is what you think is the best path. And this was my discussion with Schiffelve. It's here's what we know. Here's what we don't know. Here's what we're trying to figure out. Here's what we think the best path is based on what we know. Look, I'm happy to defer to the expertise of virologists and epidemiologists and infectious disease experts. I don't have any expertise in that space. But I'm not when you make godlike pronouncements about things that you don't have omniscience about. And for public health professionals to allow themselves to be used as cover for politicians and then for them to use politicians as cover. Basically, you know, I know my decisions are driving the decisions or my advice and counsel is driving the decisions being made by politicians. But I'm going to pretend I'm just, you know, providing advice and counsel. Don't blame me. Talk to him or her. And the politician says, hey, I'm just a politician. I'm listening to the experts, science and data. Don't blame me. Talk to them. And there's no accountability for how far off, number one, the data and science that the decisions were based on turned out to be in so many respects. Number two, how understated was the appreciation for the damage inflicted by lockdown policies. Those are the issues. A little bit more forthrightness and a little bit more humility across the board, I think, would go a long way. When we come back, microbiologist and USA Today columnist Alex Barazow will join us to talk all things COVID-19 related, as well as and necessarily including the need for public health professionals to rehabilitate their reputation.
Seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're now pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Alex Barazow, microbiologist, USA Today columnist, Vice President of Scientific Communications at the American Council of Science. Alex, thanks for being with us again. We appreciate it.
Greetings once again from Poland, where we're just now emerging from lockdown.
Well, so what about just this discussion as we're seeing the spikes that were somewhat anticipated, really largely anticipated, in states that have reopened, renewing this debate, and then folding in the discussion of what to do if the second wave comes in the fall and in the winter and it's severe?
Well, I wanted to first weigh in on what you were saying before about public health officials needing to regain their credibility. I absolutely agree. And I think there's going to be a reckoning that's going to happen, because it was very noticeable, and not just by conservatives, it was very noticeable that public health officials said, you need to stay at home or you're going to kill grandma. Oh, but if you're going to go out and protest for Black Lives Matter, that's fine. That's a public health issue as well. Now, wait a second. You can't have it both ways. Those are mutually incompatible. And Politico, of all places, ran a headline that said social justice is more important than social distance. So Politico picked up on it, and they noticed the hypocrisy as well. And so this is going to have, I think, repercussions politically for a lot of politicians. And it should, because when you say, sorry, the lockdown protests aren't safe, that's bad, but anti-racism protests, those are good, that's safe, go ahead and do that, that's no longer a scientific decision. Now it's a political decision. And public health officials have been telling us, it's all about the science, it's all about the science, it's all about the data, and that's just simply not true. And I think everybody sees through that now.
And we need to learn from and not repeat the mistakes that were made, including the catastrophic decisions made by some governors to send the infected back into nursing homes, for example.
Are you suggesting that putting the fox inside the hen house was not the
smartest
idea?
Not the smartest idea.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely correct about that. And now we have a better idea of who's vulnerable and what we should and should not do. So, yes, I hope that we learn some lessons, and I hope it works. But I think we will see a second wave. And so I think that's why public health officials are reluctant to just say, well, we were wrong, because they are fearing what's going to happen this fall.
Yeah, but you know what? Trying to induce fear to get compliance is terrible public policy. You treat people like adults and explain to them. And it is worth pointing out, by the way, it may behoove them to have a little bit higher opinion of the American citizen, because you had Americans that were social distancing and starting to take precautions well before politicians inflicted lockdown policies, because they were listening to people saying, this is a good idea, this is a good idea. So, you know, you can persuade people, too. You could try that. Be honest with them and try and persuade them.
Unfortunately, that's not the go-to policy for a lot of people.
Yeah, I know. Right? I know it's not. But
they prefer the you know, the stick instead of the carrot.
Yeah. Give us your sense. We talked to Dr. Jonathan Ellen, the former CEO of Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital, the other day, and he talked about dexamethasone as both he did a doctor out of L.A. who runs an intensive care unit, talked about this as potentially, you know, the caveat about this needs to be checked out, the numbers need to be replicable and all that, but potentially revolutionary with respect to treating the most severely ill COVID-19 patients, those with the oxygen treatment or on a vent. And if you could save the lives of those with the most severe cases, we know we can save lives of those with the less severe cases, this really could be a game changer, yes?
I think game changer is a bit strong. It's an advance, but I don't know if it's a game changer, and here's why. What the scientists found, I believe these were Oxford University scientists out of the UK, they found was that if you give this drug, it's a steroid, which is an anti-inflammatory, so it helps turn off your immune response. If you give that to patients who are on ventilators, and people who are on ventilators are in really, really bad shape, if you give it to people on ventilators, the mortality rate falls from 40% to 28%. Now that's significant, right? I mean, that's nothing to sneeze at. But still, if you're on a ventilator, you got more than a 1 in 4 chance of dying. Okay, so it was 2 in 5, now it's 1 in 4. So that's good. I think it's a very legitimate advance, and this is a good thing that we found it, but I don't see it as a game changer. What I think of as a game changer is something that people could take prophylactically, perhaps. You can give me a pill every day and I won't get coronavirus, or a vaccine that would prevent the coronavirus. And neither of those seems to be happening anytime soon. The idea that you can take a pill and prevent coronavirus will probably never happen because we don't have any drug like that for any other virus. And the second thing is that the idea that we'll have a vaccine anytime soon, I don't know. AstraZeneca, the pharmaceutical company out of the UK, they are promising 400 million doses of their vaccine by the end of the year that will be shipped to the U.S. and to the U.K. So we'll see. It's currently in clinical trials. They obviously see something that they like because they're mass producing it and the clinical trials aren't done yet. But, you know, if this second wave comes back, by the time we have a vaccine, the second wave is already going to be underway.
Yeah, so that speaks to this policy discussion that we're having, you know, about returning to lockdown policies, which is that's just not going to be tenable. But in addition to that, the need to understand you have got to fully reopen, not just not lockdown. You've got to fully reopen. And the idea you can prevent gatherings of more than 40 people until there's a vaccine or even more draconian measures is insane.
Yeah, I agree with that. But as you correctly noted, a lot of people voluntarily started social distancing before the government issued a lockdown. I think the same thing is going to happen again this fall. If we start seeing a second wave, people are going to go, you know what, I'm not going to go out of the house for a while. I'm staying at home again. And that's fine. People are free to make their own choices, but that will have economic repercussions. And I fear, now I'm not an economist, but I do have a brain and I can see, well, if 20 or 30% of Americans decide to just stay home for Christmas and not go anywhere, that's going to really hurt the economy yet again. Mm-hmm. And so even if there are no lockdowns, I fear that voluntary self-isolation may cause another hit for our economy at the end of the year.
He is Alex Berezow, Vice President of Scientific Communications at the American Council on Science and Health, PhD microbiologist and columnist for USA Today. Alex, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and Brandon Straka is back in the news. Brandon Straka, we've had him on the show before, friend of the show. He founded the hashtag Walkaway campaign, encouraging people to leave the Democrat Party of today. Straka is the one you may recall has organized garbage pickup efforts in big cities around the country, putting together these campaigns with some grassroots support, you know, enlisting local Republican organizations, but anybody else who wants to participate in just trying to set a positive example by picking up garbage or in particular neighborhoods, particularly minority neighborhoods, as an olive branch for consideration of joining the Walkaway campaign in part. Well, Straka, if his walkaway campaign hasn't marginalized him in certain sectors of society, then certainly his unwillingness to comport with face mask orthodoxy might. The story about American Airlines requiring passengers to wear masks lest you be banned from American Airlines. Well, it turns out that's a story about Brandon Straka, the first passenger to be banned by a major U.S. airline after this happened on his flight. Well, what would have been his flight on American Airlines.
This is insane. Absolutely insane. So we don't even have a choice anymore.
I'm just being told this is the law. I have to get off, but it's not the law.
This is what America follows. If you do not wear a mask, we're going to ask you to come off the aircraft. I'm asking you not to report.
I'm sorry that you don't like it, but I mean, I don't like wearing a mask.
Well, I'm going to ask you to come off the aircraft.
And so he go. It is worth noting there is Straka's right. There is no federal mandate requiring passengers to wear masks on board a plane. But on May 11th, all major U.S. airlines put new policies in place stating that passengers and crew have to wear face coverings in order to fly, passengers and crew. Exceptions exist for kids, passengers eating and drinking, and for those with certain medical conditions. not liking wearing masks isn't one of those exceptions. But, I mean, under the Americans for Disabilities Act, there are specific exceptions. And if you claim an exception because you have a pulmonary condition or PTSD, severe anxiety, claustrophobia, some people who have autism who are sensitive to touch and texture, then businesses do have to make reasonable modifications to face mask policy so that a person with a disability can participate in or benefit from the programs offered or the goods and services that are provided. So Straka is directionally correct. He should have gone the way of the person who gets a note from their doctor so they can bring a peacock on the plane as their support animal or a small pony on the plane as their support animal. You just, anxiety and only my Shetland pony can keep me calm during a flight. If he would have done that approach, maybe he could have got away without the mask. But instead, he's fighting the fight for all of those out here who understand that these surgical masks on flights or elsewhere, it is all so much COVID-19 theater. So my mask's off to you, Brandon Straka. This is Dan Pratt.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.
The world is a complicated place. You need someone to expose the political fakers, fixers, and takers, and to cut through the mindless chatter and misdirection to help you make sense of it all. That person is Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. Follow us on social media at Dan Proft Show on Twitter and Facebook. Our next guest, Libby Evans, wrote a piece, thepostmillennial.com, about the New York City school system. And it's timely because Thomas Sowell, the great Thomas Sowell, has an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal in advance of his new book, Charter Schools and Their Enemies, which comes out at the end of this month, the end of June. And Thomas Sowell's review of New York City's charter school movement is that predominantly Black and Hispanic students from families who live in low-income neighborhoods are being served. In 2019, he writes, most students in the city's public schools failed to pass the statewide tests in math and English, but most of the city's charter school students passed in both subjects. Back in 2013, a higher percentage of the fifth graders in a Harlem charter school passed the math test than any other public school fifth graders in the entire state of New York. The success of New York City's charter schools is not only a threat to the educational dogmas. Competition from charter schools is an existential threat to traditional public schools in low-income minority communities, which tend to have even lower educational outcomes than traditional public schools as a whole, writes Thomas Sowell. And while acknowledging the obvious, not all charter schools succeed and not all traditional public schools fail, the preponderance of the evidence is that most charter schools are do decisively better for their students than traditional schools, even in situations where they're housed in the same buildings and in situations where, by extension, they draw from the same populations, which is why in 2019, there were more than 50,000 New York City students on waiting lists to transfer into charter schools. Nothing is more of an indicator of the failure of a system than people want to leave it. And maybe there's some other reasons they want to leave, too. Have something to do with the curriculum in addition to academic proficiency. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Libby Evans. She's a senior editor for the Postmillennial, contributor to Spectator USA and the American Conservative. Libby, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Dan.
So your piece, you focus on curriculum and what your 10-year-old son is being taught at his school. Mm-hmm. And what is that?
Yeah. So my son is in fourth grade. We live in Brooklyn. He goes to a New York City public school. He had been in a private school previously, but it had closed. And the school came with rather high marks. So we decided to give it a try. But what has happened is that the school has taken on a radical leftist ideology with regard to the teaching of anti-racism. And primarily what that does is divide the kids. And it teaches white kids to be ashamed of their families and backgrounds because of the preponderance of historical racism that travels through families. The problem I had with this was not the teaching of, you know, difficult subjects in American history, such as racism or, you know, Jim Crow laws or, you know, redlining or any of these things that we have experienced that were and have been very detrimental to the Black community. The concern that I had with this style of education was the focus that it put on white students for their own personal racism and the personal racism within their families, which was taught as factual, that this is just a factual situation, that white people are basically racist and that racism is passed down in families. I'm sure, you know, there's no doubt that I'm sure that happens, but to divide the kids and otherize the children from each other, I found really damaging.
Otherize is a good word. Yeah, that's right. For all, yeah. I like that. I like that because it uses the left's vernacular against them. That's what they're doing. You're right.
Yeah, and for sure, I came out of the left. You know, I came out of the arts community where all of this stuff among adults was very rampant and you know, discussed at length in the arts communities. But what happened also in my son's case is that he's the only white kid in his class. There also aren't any Black kids in the class. So for most of the students, this was primarily an intellectual exercise with right and wrong answers about how primarily the lesson was that Black people in the United States are victims and to be pitied, and white people are perpetrators of completely illogical racist practices.
Is this a 1619 project curriculum in the school, or is it just the critical race theory and this is their version of it at your son's school?
There hadn't been a lot of this. They were teaching American history in pretty straightforward ways. You know, at home, my son learns a fair bit about history as well, so it's not that these things were unfamiliar to him. This actually sprung up in direct reaction to the police killing of George Floyd.
Right.
So what happened was Floyd was killed. There were a lot of protests. There was the addition of riots, you know, massive civil unrest, and the teachers, and not just the teachers, in fact, but the school administration and the Department of Education of the city of New York, headed by school chancellor Richard Carranza, decided that all of this stuff should be addressed through the lens of critical race theory.
Right.
So the first thing.
One of the things you point out, this is an important statement that you make in your piece. The school is teaching kids how to interpret history before they learn the history they're meant to interpret. I mean, that is a great working definition of indoctrination, not education.
Yeah, and in fact, during the, when we have like a Zoom call of this classroom, the teachers actually said, I don't think you guys learn about, you know, the Civil War until fifth grade. And I'm like, what are we talking about? I don't think you guys learn about Jim Crow laws until fifth grade. And I'm like, if you haven't learned the history, shouldn't we start there? You know, students should be taught critical thinking, taught how to form opinions, how to parse information, how to determine from that information and additional critical sources what they think. They shouldn't be told what to think. They should be taught how to come to their own independent conclusions. And it's disingenuous because, of course, part of the curriculum as part of the anti-racist curriculum, and I'm a firm believer in anti-racism education, I just don't think that blaming white kids is the way to do it, because additionally, they're not given any course of action. So the children are told that systemic racism requires a systemic approach, but they're 10 years old.
Yeah, but also in charge of anything. Right, but also there is no way. There's no way around this. I mean, as you're sort of pointing out, critical race theory is the opposite of critical thinking. It's anti-critical thinking. And as liberal academics like Peter Bargosian have pointed out about critical race theory, the way it works, as described by Robin DiAngelo, the best-selling author of you know, critical whiteness aspect of critical theory, race theory. The question is not, did racism take place, but instead, how did racism manifest in this situation? In other words, all situations contain racism, and it's up to the anti-racist activist to uncover it. To do anything else is described as being racist by upholding racism. So you're forever right. guilty, and there is no way out of that trap.
That's exactly right. So after the series of lessons on this, I talked to my son about it, and he was concerned that his parents are racist. He was concerned that his grandparents are racist. And I had to explain to him that he was not racist. You know, that the only that racism is, I believe racism exists primarily in individuals who are not thinking things through. I don't know how you're meant to think things through, since nobody's actually taught critical thinking at this point. But I, you know, I'm telling my son, like, what can we do about racism? We can approach everyone that we meet with respect. We can understand that, you know, we're all equal in the eyes of the law and in the eyes of God, and there's no way around that. No one's better or worse than anyone else, regardless of their social standing or skin color or national background or anything like that. And to just approach the world with a generosity of heart. There's nothing else to do other than that. And that was not part of this lesson. Instead, part of this lesson is, you know, white people are perpetrating racism and, you know, you don't even know it because it's, you're not even aware of it.
Right.
So
right.
What are you supposed to do with this as a 10-year-old kid or as a parent trying to actually inspire a child to look at the world with egalitarian eyes?
Well, good luck with your son's education and fighting against that sort of mindless curriculum. Libby Evans, senior editor for the Postmillennial, contributor, Spectator USA, and the American Conservative. Libby, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Take care. That's when spoke was spoke. And was
seat and sharpen your pencils. Class is in session with Professor Dan Proft and the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. A friend of mine, John Wood Jr., who is with an organization called Braver Angels out of LA, had a good piece in the Wall Street Journal. Black lives can be very different. He notes, I'm a 33-year-old biracial African-American. My father's white. I would have been no less a slave for that in 1820, no freer in the Jim Crow South in 1920. No less slave than that in 1820, I think I should have said. But in 2020, I can look back fondly on my childhood in multicultural Culver City, California. I trusted teachers. I trusted our local politicians whose children I knew. I trusted the police. 15 miles away in the Jordan Downs Project in Watts, a 4-year-old girl was trapped in a war zone. The woman I would marry 15 years later remembers gunfire and the explosions. She remembers the sirens and the impotent efforts of authorities to gain control as her neighborhood erupted. She remembers innocent people caught in the crossfire. That was the beginning of my wife's experience. Gangs, a failing education system, the abuses of law enforcement. This is the lens through which many Black Americans see their future. It is a present implied by the bitterness of the past. And so he asked some questions for consideration, given the different experiences he had growing up as compared to his now wife. The pain is real, but so is the progress that our ancestors fought for and realized. Do we conserve and build on it in search of Martin Luther King Jr.'s beloved community? Or do we reject an American project for which our own people have sacrificed so much? This is a conversation for all Black America. It's a conversation for all those who would stand with us. Great question. Do we conserve and build on all the progress our ancestors fought for and realized? Or do we reject an American project for which our own people have sacrificed so much? For more on that, we're pleased to be joined by Keena Collins, nationally recognized gun violence prevention and healthcare advocate. Keena, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
What about that question that John Wood Jr. raises, the choice before all of Black America and all those who stand with Black Americans?
I think that we are in a time where we can, you know, men lie, women lie, numbers do not. And we are living in a state of emergency in Black America. And whether that's through state-sanctioned police violence and brutality or rapid gunfire that is happening through intercommunal violence, those are things that we're still working on. But what I think the movement for Black Lives is trying to say is that no longer can you write policy about us without us. And so bringing to the forefront all these issues that historically, since the inception of Black people coming to America, which was stolen labor, us being brought here forcefully, now we see all of the generational impacts that has had up until present day. While we can talk about a variety of successes and victories that we've had as a collective, there's so much more that's left to do.
So give us an example of a policy or two that you would like to see implemented.
Definitely. I definitely think that healthcare is, I actually ran for Congress here in the Illinois 7th Congressional District. In the Illinois 7th, we actually have the largest life expectancy gap in the country. So that basically means if you live in Streeterville, you live to the average age of 90.
No, we've talked about it in the show. I'm in Streeterville, average age 90, and in Inglewood, and 7 miles away, it's 60. That's right.
Yep. So for me, healthcare is at the top of the ballot for any race, whether you run in a deep red district or a deep blue district.
Wait a second. Danny Davis is your congressman in the 7th Congressional District. He's a longtime politician who's been in positions of power both at the local and now the federal level. What's the problem there?
Well, as I challenged him on the campaign trail, he's taking corporate PAC money from pharmaceutical industry. And you know, like I said, anybody who knows me knows I'm an equal opportunist as far as accountability goes in our politics. And I think that the people should come over profit. So healthcare is the number one thing. I do support a single payer Medicare for all system because I think that it's comprehensive. I think that it includes everybody, specifically here in the African-American community, that would have the ability to have full access to quality healthcare. And this is particularly important given what was uncovered through the healthcare disparities of pre-existing healthcare conditions. Now that the novel coronavirus has broken out, the African-American community got hit the hardest. That's because why? We have lead in our water. We live in food deserts. It's not enough investment infrastructurally in our communities. And those are things that I want to definitely fight for. And so healthcare is the core of everything.
So would you say that Black politicians throughout several generations now, particularly in Chicago and Illinois, have failed the Black community?
I wouldn't say all of the Black. I mean, that's just generalizations. I think the political system as a whole. I think it just singling out Black politicians would be premature. I think we need to look at a wide sweeping all across the board.
Well, you did. You ran against Danny Davis. I mean,
yeah. But if Danny Davis was Asian American, white American, whatever, and he was taking corporate PAC money, and we have the largest life expectancy gap in the country, I'm going to call you out regardless.
Oh, I know.
So it was less about.
Isn't that interesting? Right. So then it's about policy. It's not about race.
Yeah, that was essentially what we were running on, is that it is about policy, but it's also the underlining. So if you're trying to make that into an I gotcha question,
I'm trying to understand your position. Is it about policy or is it about race?
Both, because what we know is that the race impacts the policy and who gets resources. Really? And how do we know that? Because Streeterville is a swanky, whiter, wealthier portion of our district, and Inglewood is a more working class Black portion of our district. And that's not just unique to the Illinois 7th Congressional District. You can go all across the country. And I don't think that that's by coincidence.
Wait a second. Danny Davis represents both neighborhoods.
Yeah. So I'm not getting what your point is.
Well, wait, you're saying the rich white areas get more resources and the poor Black areas get less resources. Danny Davis represents both. So
yeah, Danny Davis represents. You're right. Danny Davis represents the Illinois 7th Congressional District. Brandon O'Reilly, he's an alderman in the ward. Michelle Smith is an alderwoman in the ward that encompass the Illinois 7th Congressional District. And so, once again, it goes back for me, the fight when I came in and ran for Congress in the Illinois 7th Congressional District, it was about taking on corporate interests versus the working class families, which is overwhelmingly what our district is. And that's what we really, essentially what the voters were talking to us about as well. And so it was white elected officials, and it's Black elected officials in the city of Chicago.
Yes, exactly. And the white and the Black city officials, what do they have in common?
I mean, I think that corporate money plays too big of a role in our policy making.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing.
Number two,
I also do believe that vulnerable communities and on the west sides and south sides of the city of Chicago, which are Black enclaves of the city of Chicago, historically have been ignored, especially the neighborhood that I'm from, the Austin neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
We still haven't recuperated from 1968, from the King riots. they still haven't rebuilt small businesses over here.
Right.
And so I don't think that that is a coincidence either. So there was a multitude of things. I think that agitated voters in our district that we heard from, and I think historically, if we're going to talk about public policy, we also have to talk about the historical context behind how municipal and federal and state all play a role and how these resources are allocated. The Voriac 29, which was a group of white aldermen when Harold Washington was elected, and that was right around the time that Danny K. Davis was elected into city council. They intentionally blocked resources here on the west side of Chicago and south side. That is a fact. That's not how any... they were upset that the first African-American mayor was elected. Yeah. Those are the historical facts.
When we come back with Keena Collins, let's discuss the composition, both racially and intellectually, of the politicians in Chicago and in Illinois more generally. More with Keena Collins coming up.
The Dan Proft Show on the Salem Radio Network.
We're back with Keena Collins, and let's do a little bit of an assessment of the political class in terms of performance. The recent past, you know, there's been enough of a probationary period for a lot of other politicians who suggest they're in solidarity or are elected to serve their black constituents in these majority black wards, majority black legislative districts, majority black congressional districts, or plurality black congressional districts where blacks have significant political power. And it just hasn't worked out that way. And by the way, that's sort of the story nationally over the last 50 years, if you look at where black representation was in, say, the House or the Senate in 1965 versus where it is in 2019, and that includes governor's mansions and around the country, too. And yet in urban centers like your neighborhood, the neighborhood you grew up, Austin, arguably across many quality of life metrics, as we were discussing, the quality of life has actually declined for black Americans in those neighborhoods, in those districts over the last 50 years as representation has increased, as political power has increased. How do you explain that? If it's about policy, couldn't it be that the whole mentality, the whole policy agenda of big city, big government politicians has been wrong? It hasn't helped. It's actually hurt.
No, not necessarily. What we have seen nationally around just politics in general is very tribal, number one. And for example, I think that on the federal level, if we're talking about the president of the United States of America, the problem that with that argument of big government versus, you know, the government staying out of policy, then we have to keep that across the board. You know, we see full on attacks for reproductive health care. So for me, I think it goes both ways. And I think that we need a complete overhaul. And that's what we see happening in these protests. Younger people are becoming more politically agitated and more politically engaged in the process. I would also argue that the first piece of civil rights legislation that I ever wrote was House Bill 5544, the Illinois Council on Women and Girls Act. At the time, Bruce Rauner was still the governor of the state of Illinois. And we know what he did. He created a budget impasse that basically hit communities like Austin the hardest. Even if our state reps were trying really hard to get those resources to us, it was virtually impossible because he would not move on it.
Even if I stipulate to that, Bruce Rauner was governor for 4 years. Donald Trump has been in office for 3 years. We're talking about a problem.
But these issues are not in a vacuum. They happen generationally.
Exactly. No, exactly.
Generationally.
I mean, and so politically,
if we're talking politically, black folks in America have not had that much political power if we're looking at the entirety of the political ecosystem of America. That's just not true. My sister was born in 1981. We are the first generation of African Americans to have full civil liberties given to us. Our parents grew up in Jim Crow. Their parents grew up in the Black Codes, and their parents grew up in slavery.
I don't dispute any of that. The issue is, what's the trajectory? What is the progress being made concurrent with the policies being pursued? And what I see is opportunities and quality of life declining, even as political strength is growing. That's the disturbing trend line.
But that's not true. Political strength. Well, how are we describing political strength?
Well, I don't know. I mean, in Chicago, Lightfoot and Fox and Preckwinkle and
Once again, you are talking about symbolic victories. I'm talking about electoral power and policy change. When we talk about what's happened in Georgia, for example, there's real life voter suppression happening. So when we talk about who Black folks can vote for, it's already a hurdle for us to even have the ability to vote in some of these places. That's an extra layer and an extra fight that we are putting up with.
How do you explain Chicago? There's no hurdles electing Black people citywide, countywide here.
The thing about the city of Chicago is that it always has operated. We all know about the Chicago machine. But what we did see in 2015 when the Laquan McDonald tape was released was that we did begin to see cracks in the armor. For the first time in 2019, for the first time ever, we saw the entire Black caucus in the city council primaried. They had challengers. That's the first time that that had happened, I think, ever. And that was out of these protests that were springing up. What I was saying, what I'm seeing is a Black millennial, both Black Republican millennials and Black Democratic millennials, being upset and frustrated with the entire picture of our political landscape.
Good.
And so I think that in the next few primaries, you are going to see more people run for these seats, younger people run for these seats with a breadth of diversity on the issue.
Well, that's one of the more optimistic things I've heard in the last couple of weeks. So why don't we end in an optimistic, hopeful note? Keena Collins, nationally recognized gun violence prevention and healthcare advocate. Keena, thank you for joining us. Appreciate your comments.
Thank you for having me on.
Take care.
Listen to podcast of the show at danproftshow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. As Trump rally season reopens, perhaps time to take stock of where we find the presidential race with just 5 months to go before Election Day. And Trump endured another punishing week, in part coming from inside the House, or formally inside the House, in the form of John Bolton's release of excerpts from his book and his interview Sunday night, this coming Sunday night, with Martha Raddatz. Excerpts of that released, of course, as well. Bolton talking more about some of the reaction he's getting, starting from the president.
I think it's unbecoming of the office of president. I think it degrades the political civil discourse in our country, and I'm just not going to respond to it.
Not going to respond to it, but as the Wall Street Journal opined, in terms of degrading service to our country, it's hard to tell who looks worse, writes the Journal. The former national security advisor for writing it while President Trump is still in office, the book, or his lifelong political opponents, who now hail Mr. Bolton as a truth teller, or lastly, the president of the United States, as depicted in the book. Bolton, a frequent Journal op-ed contributor, Wall Street Journal writing, "We have gone to the barricades on Bolton's behalf more than a few times." His account of Mr. Trump's private words and actions sounds right, because the president often says similar things in public. As far as we know, Mr. Bolton has never lied to us. Similar things in public, maybe in part some of the things that were suggested, but really he green-lighted, gave rhetorical support to President Xi erecting concentration camps. Well, I'd like to hear more specifics on that and the context as well. Oh, by the way, it is worth noting, as I noted on yesterday's show, that some accounts of what President Trump is accused of having said by Bolton are disputed by other advisors who were in the room when it happened. So as Bolton's book is entitled. And by the way, a friend of mine had a fun reaction to that. Bolton's title, The Room Where It Happened, sounds like the diary of a 12-year-old boy's first self-encounter. The journal goes on to suggest, yet we also have to wonder what happened to honor in public service, since Bolton invoked honor in public service. Presidents should have some expectation their advisors will wait until they kiss and tell, especially about their private conversations with foreign leaders. It used to be that advisors wouldn't write about the presidents they served until they had left office. In addition to that, they point out there's no reason for Bolton to disclose private comments allegedly made by Secretary of State Pompeo. All he's doing is undermining Pompeo's ability to influence Trump in the policy area. They characterize Bolton's book, as they defend Bolton at the outset, as I described, as a blot on his distinguished career, the contents of which will not help his country, no matter who wins the November election. Interesting. Interesting. I'm sort of in that camp. I disagree with Bolton on some things. We've had him on my programs over the years, at both the station I'm at on now and stations I'm on now, as well as previous stations where I worked. And it, always an enjoyable interview, a thoughtful guy, smart guy. But I think it's a bad decision here, particularly the form that it's taking. But I think this will also be quickly forgotten, like so many other kiss and tell books from former Trump advisors or from the, you know, D.C. press corps supposedly talking to all the whisperers in and around Trump world. So the bigger issue is how Trump frames the last 5 months of the campaign. I agree with Kim Strassel, who has suggested that Biden wants to make this a referendum on Trump. Be quiet, which is why you have Obama advisors publicly saying it's fine that Joe Biden stays in his basement. We don't need him out there. Stay in the basement. They're telling you that their play is make this election a referendum on Trump. He can't win. If Trump makes it a choice, then I don't think Biden can win if he effectively makes it a choice. And so what is the choice? Is it capitalism versus socialism, or free markets versus central planning? Is it law and order versus the mob rule, the violence as the means to get the things that we demand, as has played out on the streets? Is it the technocracy and the expert class, the swamp, the insiders versus the forgotten men and women of America? I think, frankly, many of the themes that Trump used in 2016 are even more relevant in 2020 because we were flying high and Trump was keeping many of the promises he made as America was enjoying a rising tide that was lifting all boats. And as Strassel points out, and so does Selena Zito, Trump touts the low, historically low black and Latino unemployment rate because he's genuinely proud of that. That's a real accomplishment. He's proud of it. He's happy about that. Or he was until the lockdowns changed all that. So now you're in a situation where the response was a consensus response, but the damage is also real, and it's particularly to be found with respect to people on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum. Kim Strassel calls for sort of a forward-looking unity message, MAGA for all, which is basically a 2.0 of 2016. The bleak headlines of the last several weeks and frankly several months, the death and the destruction and the divisiveness. She writes, in those bleak headlines is an opening for Mr. Trump to embrace a second-term opportunity agenda. A promise that free market policies won't only revive the struggling economy, but throw it open to those forgotten Americans. Opportunity zones and school choice and healthcare choice and deregulation. This is about extending opportunity to the small business owner, entrepreneur, to the workaday man or woman trying to claw their way up the socioeconomic ladder while also providing for their family. These are the themes Strassel suggests he strike in terms of elections being about the future and an optimistic note and a better tomorrow, while at the same time and you can do more than one thing at the same time. You can walk and chew gum. You can run parallel messaging tracks at the same time, issuing the appropriate warnings for what kind of America we're going to have if, as Joel Pollack from Breitbart suggested to us this week, you have Biden in the White House with Obama-era advisors implementing Bernie Sanders policies. And that's what you'll have. This is Dan Proft.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show, and let's end the week on a bit of an optimistic note, a hopeful note on the area of policing, law enforcement, restoring faith in law enforcement, restoring respect for law enforcement, you know, both directions. Like we talked about with John Ponder earlier in the show, that respect and understanding that needs to flow in both directions. Senator Tim Scott has a very good op-ed in USA Today, touting his police reform legislation that he introduced earlier in this week. And he talks about, you know, his experience with police. At the age of 21, I was pulled over for simply having an improper headlight, and yet the officer felt the need to place his hand on his weapon and call me boy. Even today, while I have the privilege of serving as the United States Senator, I'm not immune to being stopped while driving at home in South Carolina or even while walking on the grounds of the Capitol. Each time I hold my breath and each time I've been able to exhale and go about my business, thank God. All right. So, I mean, you have to give consideration for the perspective of Tim Scott and other people who have had those experiences. Absolutely. Which is why Tim Scott can be such a constructive force in this conversation. And you know what? We should let him take that leadership role to be that constructive force. He adds, although I have had some unpleasant experiences with law enforcement, I'm optimistic we are closer to solutions that balance the scales of justice for all Americans. And he goes through the three buckets of his Justice Act: police reform, accountability, and transparency, accurate information surrounding uses of force. Today, only about 40% of police departments report this information to the FBI. This bill would change that. And he memorializes one provision for George Floyd and Walter Scott. Walter Scott, who was shot in the back by a police officer, killed. That police officer went to jail for murder, by the way. Justice system working in that case. George Floyd, Walter Scott, requiring states to report on all incidents involving the use of force and officer-involved shootings where an individual is killed or seriously injured. So that's on the information and thus the ability to information share. The second would be to expand DOJ grants to better train and recruit officers. Defunding the police is the wrong answer when it comes to solving the issues in our nation, Senator Scott says unequivocally, and it's important that he does so. And this is, again, consistent with the approach that Trump took with his executive order. And the third part of the bill focuses on the officers who damaged the reputation of the entire profession, preventing the dance of the lemons, as it were. Preventing an officer who has been disgraced from bouncing from one department to another without a record following behind him or her. We must do more than inhale and exhale. We must offer more than words and social media posts. This legislation, Tim Scott argues, is our answer to that silence, and it's our nation's chance to begin to breathe again. All right. Well, we'll see as that's picked up in the Senate in the coming weeks. Thank you for joining us this week on the Dan Proft Show. We appreciate you tuning in. Have a safe and enjoyable weekend. Happy Father's Day to all the dads out there. And hopefully we'll have you back on Monday.
Far from the fake news, he's always got the real story. This is the Dan Proft Show.
You are fake news.